Good morning. You're listening to the Conversations program on WDRT, Viralco, Wisconsin. My name is Mary Christensen, and I'm the host today. And my guest is Lars Bergen, who farms outside of Westby. And we'll just have a lot of kind of stories about mushrooms, haymaking, mycelium, agricultural kinds of topics that are happening around here in June in Viralco, in the area.
And the Watershed Council. About to have its first meeting on Thursday evening.
Perfect. Those are the kinds of things that we want to talk about. How we get connected, how we stay connected, how we work together on the soil, on the ground underneath us. Okay, Lars, do you want to start with some?
Yeah, well, I'm really tan today because we made hay yesterday, and it was really a wonderful experience. We make small bale hay, which is a big part of why I think I live in the Driftless region at all. When I was growing up, I would occasionally make hay with my uncles up on the Hunt farm, and I learned a lot about challenge and manhood and hot weather on those days. And when I was in my mid-20s, I was thinking about, like, settling down somewhere, and I think those images really stuck with me. So when we bought a farm ourselves, Karina and I, we fairly quickly commenced to making hay. And it was always kind of a struggle because there weren't that many of us, and I would have to get helpers to come from town, and I was the only one that could run or maintain the equipment. And so if something broke down, then everything would have to stop. And then we usually would make 500 or 600 bales, and it was always tough. And then 3 years ago, we decided to go shares with our neighbors on making hay. And we would just split all the hay bales 50-50, and we would store them, and we would all just work together. And suddenly we had much more help. And two guys that could run the tractor and fix things. And all of a sudden, we were making 1,200 or 1,400 bales of hay a year off the same ground.
What was that other number before?
600.
Oh, wow.
So my family still has as many hay bales as we had before, but another family has that many as well. And it makes it really fun. Like, you have dinner afterwards, and I just think of how, you know, there's epochs in time, and how the 50s and the 60s and maybe the 70s were like the small bale hay epoch. And there's big families and everyone worked together, and cows ate a lot of hay. And we're now in the round baler and corn and beans epoch, where most of the hay gets made. And now a lot of farmers even wrap their bales in plastic so they don't have to dry the hay before baling it. And I think it has changed it a lot. Obviously, the small bale is really demanding of your body and of having several bodies, but at the same time, you get just magnificently nice hay put indoors. The cows really like it. And I think it does, yeah, it connects you to other people because it takes that much help to do the job. And it also connects you to the birds because you have to drive around really slow. We don't even have a kicker on the baler, which we borrow from the neighbor. So there has to be someone on the wagon and on the tractor, often two people on the wagon. And you go slow enough because you don't want those people to fall over, and they need time to stack the bales. And I bet we had, at any given time in our visual frame, 10 swallows and 10 bobolinks the whole time. Because as you're stirring up, driving along, you're stirring up insects and exposing new ground. And so, yeah, haymaking is a whole deep philosophy. Yeah. Probably it's our favorite thing about our farm in a lot of ways. Or it's the one that covers the most area. And just, it really gets you engaged to each square foot of those hay fields because you're going over them 3 times in 4 days. And when you make your first cut is such a critical ecological decision. Right? Dairy farmers always made their first cut super early, like end of May, so they could have really vegetative, high-protein hay. But I was told early on by another farmer that, well, if you wait until the end of June, all the ground nesting birds can, they can fly before you cut the hay, and so you have way more of them.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
And I started to notice, like, year after year, yeah, we had, like, half of our farm is rotationally grazed, the other half is hayed or grazed, depending on the season. But we just have more and more of these birds that are supposedly becoming less common because they are grassland nesters, and there's less and less grassland in this country. Mm-hmm. And if it is grass, it's often hay, which is cut really early. So they arrive in early May from Argentina.
Wow.
11,000 miles away. And then they make a nest, and she sits on eggs for like 10 days. And then 10 days later, the chicks can fly. So he doesn't. And then, yeah, you're part of something. And my mother is a bird expert, and I remember asking her, like, why do we have so many birds now? Like, how do they know how to find our farm? And she said, oh, birds generally nest where they fledge.
Mm-hmm.
So that, like, these birds somehow, making that 11,000-mile trip in the dark, know how to find our place.
That's why that one robin nest keeps coming to the same place on your porch, probably.
Right.
They fledge and somebody comes back. Even if you try to move them, they just don't like it.
Totally.
Got our land. It was under CRP. Yeah, we couldn't do anything until the end of June for the same reason, for the nesting birds. I thought that was so cool.
Yeah. And I think it makes a different kind of hay,
mm-hmm.
which is like woodier, you know, more stem. But in our system, we're feeding beef cows, and a big part of what the cows are getting out of the stuff in the winter is the heat inside of their belly. And the woodier hay actually makes more heat,
mm-hmm.
makes less like milk and that sort of thing, but it makes more heat. So it works for us. And also, it's like, dang, there's so much to do in the spring. It's nice to push it off a little bit until the garden's in.
Right. Right. Well, another story we were going to talk about, or another aspect of your farm and your family, is mushrooming in the spring.
Yeah.
Which is another thing you'd want to push off the hay for, because you want to spend more time in the woods.
Right. And the mushroom part of our life is one where you really get to contemplate the difference between hunting and farming all the mm-hmm. time, right? Because one could just walk off into the woods any rainy morning and find a bunch of mushrooms. And it's fun, and it's prickly, and it's wet, and it's just like a,
mm-hmm.
it's an activity to go to the woods. But yet, mushroom farming is the opposite. It's very process, and the way I've been taught to do it or learn to do it is like, it's pretty process-oriented. You need specific tools. You need to sterilize the material sometimes. And it's the not like walking in the woods,
mm.
you know? And mm-hmm. But I think that's a big part of going back to Cain and Abel, or, you know, that dichotomy of living in the country and just being totally engaged with nature as it is, and hunting and fishing and going to look for mushrooms and maybe going to dig ramps. And those are all really fantastic things to do and do get you connected. But there is part of us that wants to farm too, right? Where you're producing more food than would be happening if you weren't in the mix, and producing specific things that are really delicious and easy to eat. And certainly mushrooms are one of those things. So we've always done some shiitake logs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you ever done those?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's just a very, like, low percentage, or I guess high percentage, high patience activity, right? Like,
yeah.
You have to really be ready to, like, settle down to do a fairly repetitive, mundane job for, like, half a day. Then you have to wait a year. And then you have to wait. Do you ever soak your logs?
I tried.
Did it work?
No.
Huh. How long did you soak them for?
Well, not long enough. You know, I'm doing it on my... you know, under a few shrubs, and I had a little kiddie pool and I put them in, and, you know, not a big production, just trying to learn.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I mean, you can learn a lot by doing a little and just watching it.
Mm-hmm.
We use the stock tank, the cattle stock mm-hmm. tank, and I'll soak them for like 24 hours.
Okay.
And because there's two things that are going on. One, you're hydrating them intensely, right? And mushrooms are mainly made of water, just like us. And so you're hydrating them, but you're also threatening them with death. Uh-huh. And that's like when, because they mushroom, those logs do need oxygen. And so they're starved of oxygen for that period. And so fruiting, what we know as mushrooming, is like a part of the mushroom's life cycle, right? Like most of their life cycle is a matter of just running their mycelial network deeper and deeper into a substrate, whether it's a log or the dirt or some sawdust or whatever. And then the fruiting is either something that seems to happen, that does happen in connection to certain conditions being met, about like light levels, CO2 levels, moisture levels, and because you can see the wild ones usually fruit at the same time of year, that somehow those networks know how much light is out there, because it seems to be most important that it be a certain time of year. And then secondly important, like the temperature and the moisture level. But with doing it, like trying to create those conditions as a farmer, you can take it really, really far or not far at all, right? Like you can just drill the logs. Do you wax yours?
No.
Oh, that's nice to do too, because like that, did you pack them with sawdust or dowels?
Dowels.
Okay. Well, that's better, because if you do it with sawdust, which is a, and seems to establish a little faster, but requires a specialty tool to like inject the sawdust into the log. You drill a hole the same way, but, and then you heat wax, like cheese wax, and you paint that hole, which both keeps the moisture in there and also protects it from birds, because birds love to peck out the sawdust, because it's like a little bit, smells different, and it's not hard to get out. So, yeah, this is the first year where we really got our waxing setup up to snuff. Mm-hmm. And the trick is just devoting an entire crock pot to it. Like, I used to do it like a double boiler situation where I'd put water in the crock pot and then put jars of wax. But it took forever. And it was hard to, like, it would almost always be a choke point in our operation eventually. But now I just put the wax directly into the crock pot, and there's always something there at the end of the day, and you just like add to it as you go, and that's worked really good. Mm-hmm. And Karina donated 5 not so good paintbrushes, so now we have really nice brushes too. And but yeah, this was the year where we got other people involved in doing that, because that's been what I've been learning about, like having farming be fun and kind of nutritive to your spirit. I think it's important to get other people involved sometimes. Mm-hmm. Not every day, because it's nice to like work quietly in your garden, like develop your own systems. But eventually, having a bunch of people out doing what you could do by yourself, but 8 times faster because there's 8 of you, is really fun. And this mushroom deal, like a lot of people will say to me, like, I'd love to come out and work on your farm with you. Like, sounds like you're doing interesting things. And I totally appreciate the intent, but it's hard to, a lot of the jobs are kind of dangerous or difficult or need a lot of training in farming. Whereas the mushroom thing, not so much. Like if you can run a cordless drill or run this little spring-loaded Japanese tool that puts the sawdust in, or if you can paint wax, or if you can just lift logs around, I can find something for you to do. And in a group, it's really fun because it's like there's no loud machinery running, really. The drill's kind of loud, but that person is usually off a little bit. And then so you have 6 or 8 people working together, learning something. They can switch jobs really easily if they want. If they get sick of something, they can just switch. And so, yeah, we have had a couple school groups out this spring and done that, and then a couple, like, just kid groups. Mm-hmm. And so... we have, and now we're making a really organized situation in the woods, so you really feel like you're walking through a mushroom area.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Because that's part of it, too. You got to be able to find them again. And you have to have it, exactly. Like, be motivated to want to check things. Mm-hmm. And if you leave it a total mess, then sometimes your own disappointment in your mess will make you not go check and see if there's mushrooms growing out of your mess, or if they're stacked in rows, you can see what's up. So,
what about keeping them wet once they're out there?
Great question. Issue? I mean, oh yeah. I mean, if I was full-time farmer, mm-hmm. I could just wake up every morning and solve farming problems. I would have a mister in the woods. Okay. Like you would run a hose up a tree and hang it on the tree, and the thing would have a plug, an electric motor, and it would, because that would do a lot. Because they, you know, when 1 year I made a fruiting room where I read the Paul Stamets books and the other books, and like they tell you how to, what conditions you're going for in a fruiting room. And mainly you're looking for like pretty much a cool mist most of the time. And then certain kinds of light and certain amounts of it. And then if you're really sophisticated, you affect the CO2 levels for different mushrooms differently. But answer to your question about the woods, yeah, it would be great. I mean, it would if you wanted to really have a business where you're supplying like restaurants and mm-hmm. grocery stores and need to have it on some sort of regular schedule, I think you'd have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you could also probably manipulate their light level with blankets in the woods if you mm-hmm. wanted to. But again, all that right now, what I'm trying to do is just learn by watching and having things going. And we're trying some new species this year. Well, or species that we failed at before, like Namaco, which is most of the real serious culinary mushroom research and practice is being done in Japan and China.
Sure.
So a lot of that's why shiitake has a Japanese name and Namaco does as well.
Is Namaco the little cluster of white ones?
Like, I've seen those in the co-op, and they sometimes say Namaco on them, mm-hmm. but they don't look anything like the pictures of what Field and Forest says I'm supposed to get. But that may be like an indoor-outdoor thing. Like, they may keep them in a really light, low condition and mm-hmm. have them grow slow and get those little clusters.
In a room.
Right.
And it controlled them.
Yeah. So, I don't know. But certainly, yeah, keeping them, finding moist places. That's the other thing that I'm starting to work with. We've dug one pond recently, and I'm dug another. We're going to dig another here this month. And leaving those logs where they have kind of like a foot in the water so they can be drawing moisture out of a stream or something, I think is a really good way too. Mm-hmm. But then you just have to put them in a place where, like, a stream is problematic because if the stream rises, they just go down the river.
Right.
So as we work, design the spillways to these ponds, I'm trying to figure out ways to, like, where there's always soggy but not flowing really. And if they did get washed, they would get washed to a really, right, just down to the bottom of the dam. So anyway, that's, I think about these things as I walk around, Mary.
It's
that's
cool.
For sure.
It's I like hearing this because it, you know, there's so much about stay connected with nature, go outside, spend 20 minutes, do this, do that. This is an amazing way to do it when you really actually go and say, where would the water flow if I needed it for my mushrooms? And, you know, there's more to it.
Right. As you start to just, and, you know, there's this, we love to have a binary attitude about the weather. Mm-hmm. Humans do, don't they?
Yeah.
Like there's a whole political movement right now opposed to climate change. Because, and I wonder what would be the opposite of climate change, Mary.
I think it's about the theories. It's not
right.
About the actual weather. Okay. Let's take a little station break here.
Okay.
You're listening to Conversations on WDRT-FM here in Viroqua, Wisconsin, which you could also be streaming on WDRT.org. And look for the archives for the Conversations program and find podcasts of past programs. And this one will be up there, too, soon. My name is Mary Christensen. I'm speaking today with Lars Bergen, a local teacher, friend, farmer. And we're just exploring all. We had a conversation about networks and mycelium and all kinds of things at one point a few weeks ago, which led to this day. of sharing our ideas. So they'll be wide-ranging, actually.
Yeah, and I, you're a person that's interested in biodynamic farming.
Mm-hmm.
And we do a little bit of that at our place, too. Not as much as perhaps we ought, but certainly we stir a couple of times a year. And generally, we haven't made the preps ourselves. We would have depended on Brian Wickard. But the notion of imparting qualities to your land rather than hard and fast, like, chemical signatures is really intriguing and makes you think about the way these mycelial networks affect the ground,
mm-hmm.
right? That, like, there's so many of them crisscrossing. Each of them, they have a particular quality. They mm-hmm. impact the soil in a particular way. And obviously the history of medicine is one of the the way that mycelial networks make and affect a substrate, the substances they put off, is the key, is the mechanism behind the whole antibiotics movement, mm-hmm. right? All those antibiotics are made by some mycelial network or the other.
As well as feeding the herbs that aren't made into chemical antibiotics but have the properties
right.
and qualities to affect the body in the same way.
Right. Yeah, and then homeopathy, which is sort of halfway in between, mm-hmm. right? Like where right. there's, it's not quite an herbal, but it's also not enough of a dose to really kill all those bugs, but it somehow, like, energizes your body to
It takes
identify
the most
them.
Important element out of the herb and breaking it up into very, 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 very small particles. It imparts the information. It's an information system
right.
through the water. The
yeah.
water holds the memory. That water goes onto the little pellet, and it comes into our body, and it releases it.
Wow.
It's very, very much tied to all these things we're talking about.
That's inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I was just noticing we stirred the horn manure prep mm-hmm. with our school group, and just watching the kids learn what a vortex is and compare their vortex to each other's, because we did, each bucket had two kids, so they could take turns, and then they could go around and look and see what other people are doing. But I was so... I've just observed it more closely than I ever have because I had 9, 10, 11-year-olds to observe it with. And how, at the beginning, you stir that vortex and it would maybe hold for like 15 or 20 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, after an hour, you could spin that thing and it would not stop for
right.
minutes.
The quality of the water changes so much.
Right,
and
it's learning that pattern. And then you... And we were in a nice spot where, like, we were kind of in partial shade so that your water was getting sun and shade on it in kind of, like, and you just, the different glint that the water took on. And when you had that deep vortex where the bottom was just black,
mm-hmm.
and you're just seeing, like, oh, that, what a tool a spinning vortex is for pulling in energy. And you think about, like, black holes, and, like, this is all around us once you see it. And but yet we just go around all day not seeing it because you didn't take the time to sit down and stir a bunch of water in a bucket with some kids, right? Like, but once you see these profound things, they're really, they encourage you, and you notice them, and you
right.
see them in clouds, and
yeah, you'll start seeing more vortexes along. You'll just see it in the word and where it's used and how many ways, and that our whole life system is a double vortex system of in and out, implosion, explosion. It's just amazing.
Right, but yet it's a circle.
Yeah.
Right? So it doesn't have, it's not like a computer where it's like on or off. It's like a tapered vessel of power.
Yeah, it's the center and the periphery.
Right.
Working together back in a rhythmical way. And that's life. I mean, that's a real principle of a life system.
Right.
So, yeah.
Do you think our society is becoming overly centralized, where the center has too much power?
Oh, I don't think of it that way, because that's still a binary system. We call it center and centralized. I don't know that it is.
Okay.
I think it's a pinnacle. You know, it's like a point. But I don't think it's not the circle I'm talking about.
Right.
Or a circle where the center is actually the universal creative energy that comes out
of
every center. So what we talk about centralized is just it's moved from localized to someplace else.
Right.
Which is then we're left out. We are the periphery with no contact.
Right.
No chain to it or communication link. Not
right,
that
certainly
it always
communication
was.
Link, because it would appear that a Democratic vote is the opposite of a communication link in some ways. Mm-hmm. Right. It's just like it's a blip about a particular thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't, there doesn't seem to create a flow of knowledge back and forth from the center to the periphery.
That's just reduced to vote. It's not reduced to process.
Right.
And process is going to take a lot more from us. It's like getting your neighbors involved.
Yeah.
It's like
did I talk
that.
About that?
Well, I mean, you did about the hay.
No, well, I was, but we're also out in the West Fork Valley.
Yes, talk about that. I love
We're starting up a watershed council.
Yeah, tell us what it is.
Well, there are several in the area already, and they're based around a non-governmental activity group in which people that live in a watershed or have kind of interest in the watershed come together to discuss issues of shared concern. I have the sign and I'll bring the poster in, but something about anyone who is interested in the health of the people, creatures, and water of the watershed can come and talk about what they're experiencing and what they the way I envision it, and I'm just one of the people involved, is that it just gets people talking and gets people showing up to see each other in a context where they're not there to consume something or decide something per se, but rather just to talk about it. And I'm especially hoping to get some of the older farmers involved.
They're there to share their practices too.
Yeah, and just to talk about the changes they've seen in 50 or 60 years of farming. And so, Thursday night, 6:30 to 8:30 at the Bloomingdale Community Club, which is the former school and now the thrift store in Bloomingdale, which is on County S, just south of County P.
We had one in Reedstown a couple months ago that I attended. In the Tainter Creek, some people came from that watershed to our watershed to, I think just to share with all of the people who are interested what they're about, how long some of them have been going on, and what kinds of real positive sharing has happened, around something like planting prairie strips of flowers and things in places that otherwise were just degraded.
Right.
And they're concerned a lot about the quality of the water.
Yeah, I think it could be a great example of a combination of a nice, pleasant community organization that one also has takes the form of citizen science, where you're
definitely
paying attention to what you're seeing, and then you have a way of collecting those views. If everyone's seeing the same issue with their stream in an area, you'd want to hey, what's causing this? If it's a strange smell or a strange taste or not as much water or way more or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And because clearly we are, the flowing waters really define here. I mean, define the world, but they define the Driftless region especially, because every valley has a stream in it. And people live on those streams and use them and swim in them and drink from them and fish in them. And so, yeah, I'm excited about it. I think that there's things that government does and needs to do, but I think that is the issue when you observe the binary system that we're in, is that when people are supposed to be sharing their views, they're more just trying to convince the few unconvinced people so that they can force the other side to do what they want.
Yeah, you could be in that mindset.
Right.
To me, I've decided that that's who the they is that we're always talking about.
Who's the they?
The people who carry that mindset.
Oh.
Just think about changing that from a personal, trying to spend a lot of time in the day figuring out who the heck it is, and just realize that if I change my consciousness in a new way, I'll be looking for other solutions.
Yeah, well, I totally agree with that. I've noticed in all kinds of organizations and situations I've been in that if you're trying to blame someone, you're not solving the problem.
Right.
You need to move beyond blame to solve whatever problem it is, because it's a very different kind of energy. Like,
and it's a different solution.
Right.
I mean, who wants to take people and beat them up and punish them compared to reconciliation, restoration of justice, healing.
Right. And everyone feeling good about what they're doing and how they're contributing, rather than like, oh, I was forced to do this, I don't believe in it. You know, like.
Right.
Yeah. Well, this mycelial network thing that has come up a few times and really makes me think about how do they make decisions?
Yeah, really. Isn't
it
amazing?
Because, and just generally, you look at nature as a form, like as the whole thing. Is there any decision making happening, or is it all one big decision? You know what I mean? Like, how do they know?
Like, when the tree next to them needs more nutrients to fight off
any of that. Or is it all just in their nature? Like watching the swallows catch hundreds of bugs an hour. Are they deciding to turn left and right at these amazingly quick? Are they deciding? Or are they just doing, right? And that, how much human energy is spent deciding?
Well, or is that a particular quality that we carry,
right?
That's needed,
mm-hmm.
and also, needs to be known when to do it, when not to do it, when.
Right.
Anyway, I don't think. I mean, yeah. I do think that we are sensing beings. We should be sensing, watching what they're doing, learning,
right.
from, and then. Pausing, allowing it to work into us to know when and how that new knowledge affects us.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, well, I was trained as a board president once in consensus decision making. And it was a real life-changing experience.
Mm-hmm.
To the one thing that was so obvious once you've heard it, but is you can't introduce an issue and decide on that issue the same month.
Right.
And that was really powerful to me, like that the sense of you first have to take it in and really work with it yourself, in a sense. You can learn about it at first meeting, but you can't like voice your opinion because your opinion is not well-formed. Like you haven't actually thought about or felt about what you're experiencing there.
But you could voice your question.
Sure.
So that everybody in the meantime in that month could be considering it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it takes time to take something in, sit with it, and then go forward. You know, this actually, can I change the topic a little bit?
Totally.
Mind? This goes along with something I've been doing this year, actually for the last 4 years, in a big way, is working with Otto Scharmer's theory, U. In the principles that they use out of the Presencing Institute. It's at MIT, the place you would not think this is happening. But this is the most amazing work, as he talks about at the bottom of this U, if you think of a U, that's where we sit. We don't jump to conclusions. We don't jump to solutions. We process and consider all the things we've been, all the information and the sharings that we've had with people, and all the stakeholders in a system, and try to and develop prototypes, and we're trying to presence the future. We're not working on solutions from the past.
Mm-hmm.
So really changing that idea. And it's hard. It's hard to change, especially if you've been a leader in the other paradigm for a long time. And we think our role there is for our wisdom to, you know, tell people what to do or whatever, come with solutions. But if it becomes one of sensing and listening and talking with all the people in the system, all of them, all the stakeholders, and creating conditions for meetings where that can happen, like these watershed councils, I'd say that's creating a condition for a new kind of conversation and meeting of each other that doesn't normally happen.
Right, and I think also if you look at yourself individually, and that if you decide that your main work on earth is actually to perfect your soul and speak the truth, then you really start to gravitate toward situations where that's allowed.
Where it's allowed, right?
Where being like courageous and forthright and patient and true are really encouraged. And that's, I think, and when I taught meditation at the high school, I would often tell the students to float up out of their body and then look down on themselves and kind of just meditate on what they saw. And I think that sense of watching yourself learn and listen and be like helpful and kind, rather than watching yourself like convince people or boss people or scare people, like,
yeah, they're quality differences, aren't they?
They really are. Yeah. It's hard to put your finger on it, but you know, I found like when I'm being that way, that there's a lot more interest in other from other people, and when I do speak, whereas if you're talking all the time, people like sort of tune you out.
There's only so much we can do without falling asleep.
Right. But I was thinking this in this network thing, in a mushroom network, which is you've got a spore, and then the network grows for an undifferentiated amount of time through an undifferentiated amount of space. And there's no distinction on that network between the parts of the network that were made on day one when the spore started and day 550.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
There's no elders or children or any of that. It's just a big network that's trying to survive and influence the environment in a particular way and shuttle certain nutrients from tree to tree and whatever else is they're doing. But like, it's a completely non-binary growth model, but they keep growing and non-hierarchical at all. Like, there's that tiny spore that you can't even see with the naked eye that's made a network that covers miles. Like, the spore is gone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But the information.
Totally.
Is there, in biology, there's in insect life, there's an imaginal state. You ever heard of that?
No.
Imaginal. It's like in the metamorphosis of the pupae of the monarch to the butterfly. There's a point in the chrysalis where everything's just goo.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing.
Yeah.
Not the what it was and not the what it is going to be.
There's just the plan.
The plan is
right
there. Yeah, and that's called the imaginal state. And I love that word because we can do that. We, in our imagination, we could allow ourselves to have an imaginal state where we are allowing ourselves to have an imagination from the future, from what we think we've learned needs to be. You know, we don't have to have it all worked out, but we can start there, inviting it to come to us.
Yeah, well, and just that, and people like Rudolf Steiner, that have real spiritual gifts, time obviously doesn't mean the same thing to them as it does to most people.
True.
Right? Like that if you can go back in time the way Steiner seems to be able to do, to like observe certain holy events or whatever, it seems that you can also. It's not like going forward in time. It's like you're entering a space where all these realities exist and you can learn a little bit about them and then come back.
Right. At least consider.
Yeah.
That it is a multidimensional world and a multi.
Yeah, I like to. Yeah. When I drive by the CAFO, the humongous 3,000 cow dairy near us, I like to imagine it being a humongous mushroom farm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like
wouldn't
that.
Smell as bad.
Yeah. Bring it on. Right. I have to take a station break, Lars.
Okay.
To let our listeners know, you're listening to the Conversations program here on WDRT FM in Viroqua, Wisconsin, or streaming on WDRT.org. You can go to the Conversations program in the archives and find all of our programs for many years. Really excellent, fun conversations with our friends and neighbors and other people from outside the area, too, but on interesting topics and fun things. So today I'm Mary Christensen, and I'm speaking with Lars Bergen from our area, from Viroqua, from Westby, from Cashton.
From rural Bloomingdale.
Rural
from
Bloomingdale.
Sunburg, Bloomingdale.
I know you kind of frowned when I said you were from outside of Westby. I thought, well, where do you want to be from?
Bloomingdale was once a thriving town. It has a nice church and a nice school that have been repurposed. Well, the church has not been repurposed yet. But anyway, mm-hmm. There was a time, and I think there's been a lot of people living probably down in Bloomingdale for many, many centuries.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice spot. But we live actually above Bloomingdale, around the corner, up the hill.
Mm-hmm.
But Bloomingdale's the closest town.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we talked about this spore forming a mycelium network and going out for miles and miles. One of the things about the Presencing Institute that has been happening for this last year is the language that they're presenting is one of the talks was titled A Journey Through Regenerative Wisdom. So, of course, we were talking about soil, and they talked about soil, planetary soil, and the fact that humans form social fields. And so we have social soil also as a metaphor. And it's so the on the soil farming level with biodynamics and whatnot, we're speaking about replenishing the microbiome of the soil so that it can produce healthier, more potent, nutritious food.
Right.
And feed our friends, the insects and the bees and others. In the social fields, we're talking the same thing. Out of what grows out of this ground? What grows out of different kinds of grounds with different soil, with different nutrients within it?
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about moving from a binary, linear, hierarchical decision-making process to one that is more consensus, circular, maybe using a vortex, who knows, what can come out of that kind of social field? So it's a really, really fun topic to work with.
It is. I also, though, one of the things that I really observe is it'd be sweet if there's a new kind of organization that didn't use any electronic communication at all to plan its meetings or do its work.
Oh, yeah, wouldn't that be nice? Some people would really love that.
Because, and that's what, when I put up these first signs for the Watershed Council, I didn't put a contact info or anything. I just said, this is where the meeting will be. And I'm kind of hoping that we can keep it pretty non-digital for a while, because I do feel like you can really... I've seen the life really get sucked out of a lot of good projects by emailing too much about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like it turns it into a chore and a task instead of like a fun thing to look forward to. And just in terms of networks, and which, you know, we've like another network we haven't discussed yet is the internet, the World Wide Web, as it's called. And its role in like covering the earth like a ball to reflect cosmic energy and intellectual and physical. Because I think it really, there probably is something to it. like something that purports to allow us to communicate more, but seems to actually do the opposite in a lot of ways.
Well, I think it can do the opposite, but you know, for somebody like me who's really grew up way without the internet,
right,
and had many, many amazing experiences over my life of communications that just had to happen that day or that week, happening.
Yeah, it is different.
Being
able to think
your friend in.
Yeah, I've had certainly amazing uses of it and experiences of myself, and I don't know how we would live without it at this point. So I just observe it.
Yeah,
you know, it's like that. There's a cosmic divine energy that wants to encounter the earth, and the more of these networks we put on the very surface of the earth. And that's certainly related to that biodynamic farming thing as well. That what part of the farmer's work is to pull cosmic energy into his place to the benefit of the entire world.
Right.
And and just how we can use these electronic technologies without having them corrupt and weaken our interpersonal skills.
Right. Well, maybe that's where we start, is to ask ourselves, do I need to really send an email on this sort of thing right now? Do I really need to comment on this? Or is this better to actually have a conversation about in person?
Right. Or in even the pesky ones of we'll be there in 20 minutes, as we decided that we would do 3 days ago already. You know, having that, it's almost like the way bats use echolocation, you know, like people pinging each other constantly to person's still there.
I did that to you last night.
Yeah, it happens. I mean, I certainly, when I go on a business trip, it's so hard to, or any sort of trip where I'm driving several hours to see someone, I kind of want to make sure they'll be there. So anyway,
gives us a lot to think about.
There's a lot to think about. The two little, I brought a list of topics.
Okay.
The two that we haven't covered are insects and butterflies.
Okay.
Because I think we think about birds and insects as these really different things. But this year I've just been noticing so many migratory birds and no butterflies.
Yeah.
But also tons of insects. We've done a pond, we've been organic for a long time, so the insects really like it at our place, but man, that's strange, you know, that but no butterflies. And certainly for most of my time at that farm, there were, you know, dozens if not hundreds of monarch butterflies at a certain point in the year, and maybe they're still coming, I don't know, but we have seen so few.
Yeah.
And I realize that butterflies are like migrating insects.
Oh, they are.
So that they are going to be the most sensitive to pesticides of all, because if you're an insect living on our farm and you're living your whole life cycle basically on this spot, the fact that the farmer a couple farms over is spraying doesn't really matter because you're living here. Whereas if you're a butterfly flying from Mexico to Wisconsin, the number of different farms you have to fly through and stop on, just one of those guys has put out a bunch of insect poison and you're dead, you know? But I hope that it's just an anomaly and that they're going to show up here in 2 weeks, but it's been really different this year.
Yeah. I have a sister in Minnesota who has for years and years encouraged monarch growth by collecting the eggs, raising them, letting them hatch, and then sexing them and releasing them.
Oh, she sexes them too. Mm-hmm.
And then releases them, and she counts every year. Last year there was a smaller release than years before, so that probably is affecting this year.
Yeah, and we usually do 8 or 10 as well. You know, we have a screen vessel for it, and you can. But last year, a bunch of them didn't. They aborted. Hmm. The pupa just kind of dissolved. Hmm. Liminal space, they stopped and didn't make it through.
Mm-hmm. Well, she does a couple of hundred of each.
Hmm.
So she's got a pretty good record of the last several years, how it's been. But I think people have studied monarchs so much more lately that they know there are some ups and downs in their
right and
populations.
And I just,
but I haven't seen many bees either, and a lot of things I haven't seen. But everything's growing so differently. What blossoms, and then how long it stays available. That's less. Anyway, it's just different this spring.
Yeah. Well, and it's also been the smoke from the north had kept us so cool.
Yeah.
And I think that slowed certain processes down too. The last 3 or 4 days have really been the first 3 or 4 hot days of the year.
Right.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, I think it's like a huge part of it is just taking joy in your own observations too, that you get to look, that you can, you have eyes to see, you have the time to observe. And that's...
The appreciative phase of things is so important.
Right.
It's like, really important.
Yeah, that all these different like environmental movements or statements I think are important in like an aggregate sense, but like I think on some level, like the human relationship with the earth just is a one person at a time activity, right? You have to decide for yourself whether you live in the country or live in town that you're going to observe closely and fairly what you see.
And appreciate everything for what it does do. I mean, it's all part of this big life system.
Right, multi-floor rose. Oh, if I could buy stock in multi-floor rose.
This year.
It is rocketed. It's everywhere. But yet, you know, people talk about pollinators. There's bees on it.
Yeah.
There's everything on it. You know, like it's...
It's needed it's this year for sure.
Doing its job. Yeah. But it is all... It's a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot.
There's probably a whole new line of clothing you could develop just for the multi-floor rose control.
And Steve has designed many different tools in his brain for how to get it out of the ground and deal with it.
Yeah. My best luck has been the chainsaw and then a bag of salt.
Oh.
You salt the stump just with like regular salt for the cows.
Yeah.
And that slows it down. You cut it again. You salt it again. And then usually that's that.
Oh, wow. That's pretty amazing.
It's pretty labor intensive. I mean, and there's hundreds of multi-floor rows on our farm, so.
Same.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we're not talking about a big farm. We're just talking up the driveway and on the by the sheds.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so, gosh, we're getting close to finishing our hour here. I want to talk about one more thing that was really amazing to me about organizations. It's something that I heard last week on the Presencing Institute. And I'm going to share it because a lot of us don't have very much hope sometimes about this big centralized system, soon to be a global system we're living in and all that, about quality of leadership and quality of process. But here's a story about a woman. Her name is Isabel Guerrero. And she was a World Bank vice president for 30 years, I think she said. Yeah, 30 years. And she was working in Southeast Asia. So she saw a lot of what happened in Bangladesh and in other places where, talk about climate is really having an impact, plus poverty and a lot of other things. So she left the World Bank after 30 years, I'm going to just read this, to learn from grassroots organizations. She says, I had seen a lot of organization in the global south under the radar who had, these organizations had the solutions but could not scale their impact. So she left the bank, went to India, worked with a nonprofit who had a lot of impact but also couldn't scale it, a Seva, I think was the organization. And after a year, she dedicated herself to only working with these grassroots organizations that were doing good work to see if her knowledge and what she had learned could help scale these solutions. So she works with Voces Nuevas and anyway, has written a book called Scaling Up. If anybody wants to read something that is probably very, you know, positive and hopeful, I'm going to be looking for it myself. And so basically, you know, she's changing her work with the social soil to trying to work with the very producers, the very people who are needy at the lowest levels in the world, and in a compassionate way, you know, bring their ideas to the table. So anyway, we need a lot more, you know, people like that, but I think they really, really are out there, and if you're interested in finding them, there are places like the Presencing Institute. There's also a book that I read a few years ago called Blessed Unrest by Paul Hawken. And the subtitle on this book, and this is from 2007, says how the largest social movement in history is restoring grace, justice, and beauty in the world. This comes from years of giving talks mm-hmm. about the sad state of the world as an environmentalist, and after every talk, people would come up to him and give them their business card on, well, look what we're doing, and this and that. And so he started collecting. One day he realized he had a whole bag of cards, and he laid them out on the table and started organizing them, and realizing that there was this network, this huge group of nonprofits, not all nonprofits, but people actually trying to respond in a responsible way to these same issues. So he felt that it wouldn't be very long when it will just rise out of the ground, just like these mushrooms out of the mycelium.
Well,
just a thought.
We'll see.
Yeah.
We can only hope.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Lars, for coming around and talking
totally.
About
thanks
these things.
Me.
I love talking with you because we can range
yeah.
all over.
Totally.
From practical to political to religious or spiritual and community. Anyway, thank you all for being our audience today and listening. Please do check out the archive on Conversations and see what other great topics are there. Thank you, Lars.
Thanks for having me, Mary.